You're listening to Mockingbird. This recording was made at the 8th Annual Mockingbird Conference, held at Calvary St. George's Church in New York City.
My name's Ethan Richardson, and I work for Mockingbird. My main gig with Mockingbird is doing the magazine now, and so... What? Oh, you're... Yeah. Gets me every time. I came across Capon several years ago with the book Kingdom Grace Judgment. Has anybody read that or know about it? Okay, and has anybody not read any Capon or doesn't know much about Capon? Okay, that's great too. Just a quick bio on the man. He grew up in the Bronx and went to, I'm gonna butcher this, Stuyvesant, I think, high school, which is, I think, a public high school here in the city that's very highly touted, and then went to Columbia and seminary, and then began work as a parish priest in Long Island, where he was married, and then also became the dean of a seminary. And I think Mercer School of Theology was the name of it. And kind of rose to prominence when he wrote sort of a family, like marriage and family book from a Christian perspective called Bed and Board. And that was back in 65, I think. And like the Christian world sort of like fawned over this book because he was someone who took grace very seriously, but also was able to write in a very funny way about how family dynamics are just messy. And messy they were. He was married to his first wife for 28 years and then was divorced and married his second wife, Valerie, to which his bishop frowned upon and sort of gave him an ultimatum, which was unfortunate for him because he had both his preaching job and his teaching job under this bishop. And so it was kind of a resign or be fired situation. And so from that point on, he became sort of a freelance writer and lived on Shelter Island, which is a little island off of Long Island. I had to do all this stuff on Wikipedia because I don't know New York geography at all. And he became a prolific writer. That's what he did. And he talks about a certain point in his life in the prologue of one of his books that was very moving for him and transformative. And so I want to read that first. And just to kind of make this less boring for you people, I don't want to be the only one reading because there's a lot here to read and it's all really good, but if you're just hearing my voice, you're going to fall asleep. It's just that time of day. So if you just got here, there's packets up front. And let's go ahead and look at the very first part. This comes from Romance of the Word, which is a collection of some of his early theological writings. But at the beginning, he kind of talks about his life and how his ministry sort of fell apart and then was resurrected. So I'll read this one and then we'll start having volunteers. So this is about the death he experienced in 1974. He actually died 2 years ago. But this is a death of sorts. Anyway, back to the turning point. Simply put, something I took as a personal tragedy occurred in my life in late 1974. I give you no details, except to say that what happened was largely my fault, and that the experience was devastating. But I didn't even begin to understand it until in 1975, I attended a clergy conference conducted by Jim Forbes, who is now the senior pastor of Riverside Church in New York City. Over 3 days, he hammered home the message that the only reason the church cannot rise from its moribund condition is that it will not die. that for as long as it tries to hang on to the life it thinks it has, it will never enjoy the gift of resurrection from the dead that God gives it in Jesus. Jesus came to raise the dead, he said, not to teach the teachable, reform the reformable, or improve the improvable. As I later came to put it myself, the only ticket anyone needs to God's party of grace and forgiveness is, by great good luck, the one ticket everybody has, death. Only after that, and only bit by bit, did I begin to understand the tragedy. I was not just devastated or hurt or ill-used or broken, I was dead. Unless you have been through such an experience, you may find this overblown. But my life, as I had known it, was over, gone, kaput. If I ever lived again, and it was inconceivable to me that I could, it would not be by my hand. You want to ask me, of course, but what about all the positive parts of your life that were still in place? Wife, children, work, success? Was it fair of you simply to write off all that as gone? You missed the point. All those goodnesses remained exactly as they were. I did not write them off. I died, just as suddenly and certainly as if I had been run over by an 18-wheeler. Fairness or unfairness, guilt or innocence, blame or exculpation had nothing to do with the case. My life-designing capabilities were not impaired or in need of remedial treatment. I just didn't have my life anymore. But far from being a sad state of affairs, that turned out to be the best news I had ever heard. My death was not the tragedy I first thought. It was my absolution, my freedom. Nobody can blame a corpse, especially not the corpse itself. Once dead, we are out from under all the blame harrows and guilt spreaders forever. We are free, and free above all from the messes we have made of our own lives. And if there is a God who can take the dead and, without a single condition of creditworthiness or a single pointless promise of reform, raise them up, whole and forgiven, free for nothing, well, that would not only be wild and wonderful, it would be the single piece of good news in a world drowning in an ocean of blame. It was not all up to me. It was never up to me at all. It was up to someone I could only trust and thank. It was salvation by grace, through faith, not works. Okay, so I'll stop there. I just think that's beautiful. I mean, it's just such a picture of death and resurrection, which for him is the essence of the gospel. We are killed by life. And we are resurrected by Jesus. And grace is this word that Capon has he's one of the most beautiful articulators of this grace. And he talks about it just spreading wildly. It's this free-for-all. It's wild. You can't contain it, and you can't even try to parse out why you got it, because you can't. You didn't get it for any reason whatsoever. And so, and this is the way that Capon sees Jesus. He sees this is his ministry, that he's bringing on this kingdom whereby love, the love of God, comes not by how well you're able to uphold the laws, but because of God's great gift. And so, I was trying to think of a great way of starting this off. Like, what's a good place, if you've never read Capon before and you want to get a picture of what his theology is all about, the place I wanted to go was his take on the parable of the sower, which is, if you're not familiar, the parable goes that there's a farmer that sows seeds, and the seeds are sown everywhere. You know, they land in the field, they land on the road, they land in the bushes, they land everywhere. And some of them pop up and some of them don't. And I've always had a hard time with this parable because I thought that, you know, you need to decide which seed you're going to be. You know, like, are you going to be the seed that nourishes the gift you've been given, that takes good care of it, that has quiet times and performs the right behavioral tasks that you need to do, or are you going to squander the gift that's been given to you? Are you going to let it get, you know, picked up by the birds or burnt up by the sun? And so Capon calls this parable the watershed of parables. He says that this is the parable of how Jesus pictures his ministry, his kingdom, and God's gift to us, to humankind. And mainly it's the way that he characterizes himself. So without going any further, let's go ahead and read. So it should be on the next page. And at the top of the page should be this word, catholicity. And the way that he, one wide theme of Capon's work is this idea of a Catholic faith that's lowercase c, not uppercase c, that is of the whole, that is widespread everywhere. And we see it in his parables, in Jesus' parables all the time, about the yeast that only needs a little bit and it spreads throughout the whole loaf. It goes everywhere. And the seed that is sown that goes everywhere. And so I'm just going to let him do the talking for the rest. So here we go. Does someone want to read? Ben, thanks.
The idea of the Catholicity of the kingdom, the insistence that it is at work everywhere, always and for all, rather than in some places, at some times, for some people, is an integral part of Jesus' teaching from start to finish. True, at the outset of his ministry, it was expressed by little more than his irksome tendency to sit loose to the highly parochial messianic notions of his hearers. By, for example, his breaking of the Sabbath, his consorting with undesirable types, and his constant challenging of the narrow views of the scribes and the Pharisees. But it becomes practically the hallmark of his teaching once he begins his use of the parabolic method in earnest. Not only does he resort, as in the parable of 11, to the occasional illustration that quite literally uses the word whole, far more often he sets up his parables in such a way that by their very terms they cover nothing less than the whole world. The device he uses may not be obvious to the casual reader, but once it has been spotted, it can be seen again and again. When Jesus sketches his parabolic characters or circumstances, he often drafts them so inconclusively that no one, at any time or any place, is left out of scope of his teaching conclusively.
Yeah. Another example is that I thought of was the wheat in the weeds. There's a parable where these farmers have sowed seed, and they wonder, you know, while it's growing, should we go out and pull out all the weeds so that the wheat can grow better? And out of this entire field, let's parse out the good things from the bad things. And the response of the landowner is, no, you need to let them all grow up together. The whole needs to reach its harvest, and then you can make the decision of what was good from what was bad. And another one is the net, which I very rarely think of, this dragnet that pulls all the crap. I mean, it pulls the good stuff and the bad stuff, but all of it gets pulled ashore. And then there's that little selection, another paragraph on the next page. Would someone read that? Guy?
In the case of the parable of the sower, however, there is still another, more subtle indication of the note of Catholicity. Jesus' parables, even when they were not spoken to anyone outside the small group of the disciples, were set forth, as I have said, in the context of high parochial ideas about God's relationship with the world. If you have any feeling for the way narrow minds work, you will realize that the sower, as told, would immediately strike such minds as reeking of the Catholicity they had spent their entire religious lives deploring. People who are that narrow do not really listen to what someone says. Rather, they sniff at his words, that check them over to spot the squishy, rotty spots through which ideas they hate might seem to run.
So this idea of Catholicity is also runs against the current of fearful exclusion, you know, like keeping some ideas at bay for fear of them possibly disrupting what they're so tightly holding on to for righteousness' sake. So here he's almost saying that this Catholicity for the Pharisees was such an offense because it was precisely by their by exclusion that they were able to stand up so tall. So Catholicity is our first thing. And then we have this idea of mystery on the next page. So in the parable of the sower, you have the imagery of a seed that's being scattered. But if anybody is a gardener or knows a gardener, when seeds go in, they disappear. And what looks like a barren field is actually filled with potential. And the way that God works, according to Capon, is by things not being seen. And it's the way that he also believes God intervenes in the world in ways that we can't see, which is oftentimes frustrating. So let's go ahead and read this next part. Does anybody want to read this? Yeah.
Consider the imagery of seed. First of all, seeds are disproportionately small compared with what they eventually produce. In the case of herbs, which for some reason Jesus took special delight in, they are in fact almost ridiculously small. Anyone who has granted time or savory knows the strange sensation of practically losing sight of the seed that has been dropped into the bowl. You might as well have sown up for all you can observe. What does that say about the word of God that the sower sows? Well, it certainly does not say what we would have said. Left to our own devices, we would probably have likened the word's advent to a thunderclap, or to a fireworks display, or to something else we judge sufficiently unmistakable to stand in for a notion of pushy, totally right-handed God. Instead, this parable says that the true coming of the Word of God, even if you see it, doesn't look like very much. And after the finally gets around to doing its real work, he's so mysterious that they cannot even be found at all. That is the second thing about seeds. They disappear. In the obvious sense, they do so, because of their need to be covered over with earth in order to function. Think of the light that sheds on the messianic secret. Jesus is taking what may have been only an instinctive dislike of publicity and turning it into a theological principle. But in the profound sense, they disappear because once they are thus covered, they eventually become not only unrecognizable, but undiscoverable as well. As far as the convenience is concerned, they simply die and disappear. Think what that says about Jesus and how it re-echoes through his whole ministry. He, as the Word, comes to his own, and his own receive him not. He is the spot. He is the stone that the village rejected. He is ministering to, not in his own recognizable form, but in the sick, the imprisoned, and the generally down and out. And to cap his whole career as the word is sown in the field of the world, he dies, rises, and vanishes. His entire work proceeds, as does the work of a seed. It takes place in mystery, in secret, in a way that, as Luther said, can neither be known nor felt, but only believed, trusted. So again, that is not our idea of how a respectable divine operation ought to be known. We would rather have casualties and agencies that were a bit more proportionate to their results. Given our genders, our pet illustration of the kingdom would probably be a giant gnat driven into the world, appropriately enough, by a giant hammer in the hand of a giant god. Something noisy and noticeable. A seed? Oh, come on.
So he's a great writer too, which makes him fun to read. But just the picture that we would arrange God's intervention in the world is not the picture that God chooses. That's the key to mystery for Capon, is that for all the world, God's action in the world seems to happen so quietly as to be unnoticeable and oftentimes unfindable, even if you're looking for it. And then he also points out that part of Jesus not wanting to be seen. Like, he performs a miracle and he says, tell no one. And so it's almost that the lived ministry of Christ is also part of this mystery, which has huge implications for the way I see my life and think about my life and God's involvement in it. But I love that line that we would rather have a thunderclap. You know, we would rather have the glory story. We would rather have something that comes in and shows us it's there and makes these changes on a visible level. But that's not what we get with Jesus. And so this has a lot to do with what Will was talking about just a minute ago, and quite a bit what everyone has really been saying, that especially I thought about Jamin talking about play and how so often the mystery of play is invisible to us in its power, and that so often we would rather choose something, you know, mechanistic that can give us a result or give us something to see. And instead, we're given something that is small and childish. So this is the next main theme that at least I really love in Capon, is this idea that he actually got, I think, from Luther, which is the idea of right-handed power and the idea of left-handed power, where we think God ought to use right-handed power and come down with a giant hammer and make things right. Instead, left-handed power is what's used. Yeah, there's right-handed power right there. And it's not that right-handed power is a bad thing, as you'll see in what we read, but it does get things done, you know. As Capon says, and we'll read this, you can lift the fork off the plate and pick up spaghetti with right-handed power. Right-handed power is just the power we use every day to get things done. But left-handed power is this mysterious power that happens almost in secret. So, much like the sower of the seed, if that's the image we're still sticking with, these seeds are just being thrown out willy-nilly. And then they're landing where they do. It's not like Jesus' story is of a prudent farmer who, you know, puts things down and rows along the soil, but it goes everywhere. It goes on the road. It goes in bushes, and that just seems kind of silly. But it throws caution to the wind. All right, so let's read this next. You're going to skip a page, actually, and you'll see right versus left hand on pages 18 and 19. And again, all of this is coming from a book called Kingdom, Grace, and Judgment, which we have on the book table. And it's basically his take on all the parables. He sort of categorizes all of the parables of Jesus as parables of the kingdom of God, parables of the grace of God, parables of the judgment of God. And for someone who had a very difficult time with parables when I was in high school and college, it completely turns some of these stories over their head. That's not the phrase, but you know what I mean. On their head. Would someone else like to read? right versus left-hand power?
Yeah.
Direct, straight-line intervening power does, of course, have many uses. With it, you can lift the spaghetti from the plate to your mouth, wipe the sauce off your slacks, carry them to the dry cleaners, and perhaps even make enough money to ransom them back. Indeed, straight-line power, quote, use the force you need to get the results you want, is responsible for almost everything that happens in the world. And the beauty of it is, it works. From removing the dust with a cloth to removing your enemy with a 45, it achieves its ends in sensible, effective, easily understood ways. Unfortunately, it has a whopping limitation. If you take the view that one of the chief objects in life is to remain in loving relationships with other people, straight-line power becomes useless. Oh, admittedly, you can snatch your baby boy away from the edge of a cliff and not have a broken relationship on your hands. But just try interfering with his plans for the season when he is 20 and see what happens, especially if his chosen plans play havoc with your own. Suppose he makes unauthorized use of your car and you use a little straight-line verbal power to scare him out of doing it again. Well and good, but suppose further that he does it again anyway. And again, and again, and again. What do you do next if you are committed to straight-line power? You raise your voice a little more nastily each time until you can't shout any louder, and then you beat him, if you're stronger than he is, until you can't beat any harder. Then you chain him to the radiator tail. But you see the point. At some very early crux in that difficult personal relationship, the whole thing will be destroyed unless you, who on any reasonable view should be allowed to use straight-line power, simply refuse to use it. Unless, in other words, you decide that instead of dishing out justifiable pain and punishment, you are willing, quite foolishly, to take a beating yourself.
Okay, pause there. So, again, he's not knocking right-handed power. He is saying that this is the way that the world works. You know, you don't come to work, you lose your job, you don't get money, and you can't feed the kids. It's simple cause and effect. But he's also saying that somehow in God's beautiful creation of human beings, we don't tend to work on a relational level in the same way. That power doesn't work. We can't just hear the words of the Father, you can't use the car, as just a fact, as an objective fact that's fair. It's an indictment, you know, and so we rebel. And so it ends up making things worse until we choose not to use it because it just doesn't work, or things get worse. But that's just a quick interruption. Go ahead. This is left-handed power.
But such a paradoxical exercise of power, please note, is 180 degrees away from the straight-line variety. It is, to introduce a phrase from Luther, left-handed power. Unlike the power of the right hand, which interestingly enough is governed by the logical, plausibility-loving left hemisphere of the brain, left-handed power is guided by the more intuitive, open, and imaginative right side of the brain. Left-handed power, in other words, is precisely paradoxical power. Power that looks for all the world like weakness, intervention that seems indistinguishable from non-intervention. More than that, it is guaranteed to stop no determined evildoers whatsoever. It might, of course, touch and soften their hearts, but then again, it might not. It certainly didn't for Jesus, and if you decide to use it, you should be quite clear that it probably won't for you either. The only thing it does ensure is that you will not, even after your chin has been bashed in, have made the mistake of closing any interpersonal doors from your side.
Okay. I just want to stop here for a second, you know, take a pulse, but you know, there are ways that we feel this strain all over in our lived experience, not just in the theological operation of Christ in God, but in human relationships like Capon's describing here. There's, you know, there's the strength that we are asked to posture in life versus the weakness that we oftentimes feel. There's like, you know, possession of things or of a job that we long for, but life commands that we surrender it. And in this example, thinking of human relationships, there's the intervention that we feel like we ought to make, and that if we could only make, things would change, versus the passivity that we just can't trust. You know, if I don't say anything, nothing's ever going to change. If I just keep loving this person, like, what am I left with? And so I just wanted to ask how this is hitting you. You don't have to share anything, but I thought we would stop here and think, like, where in life do you find this right-handed, left-handed power? What comes to mind, or where do you see it? Kurt?
Did you point to me?
No, Kurt.
See your tag.
Okay.
Let me see. Oh, I'm here. All right.
Fair enough.
As a dad, I'm going to go through really the people who are control and, you know, the correct behavior from. But what came to mind, especially with car stuff, Rod Rosenblatt.
Yeah. We were just talking about that at lunch.
Yeah, Rod Rosen, he kind of tells it as this, like, my conversion experience. Like, I became a Christian. Basically, in high school, Rod Rosenblatt is an evening senior professor, or undergraduate professor, he's one of them. Got drunk, stole his father's car with his friends in a wrecked car. And this is back in the day when the pops just took him home. Rather than, you know, taking jail, so the cops took him home, his father waiting up, he's worried about it. And his dad could see the law had already done his, well, I mean, Rod's dad was terrified. I was horribly sorry, and I was terrified of what was going to happen to me. And his dad said, well, go to sleep and talk about it. And he said he mercifully told my mother not to get involved. And so, you know, he didn't sleep that night, comes down the next morning to the breakfast table, and he's just, all right, I'm going to get it. And all that said was, why don't we go get a party? And he said, I literally would be a Christian. So, hardcore thing now.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so that's for me, at least. I'm like, well, I don't have that in me, so if it's going to happen, you're going to be.
Yeah.
You got to get that from me.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, Jim.
I'm going to share a story based on that story, highway position in the long way above.
Yeah.
Based on that story, my son was taking flying lessons. After doing some solo flying, because my dad has a license, took the car to the gas station and called us minutes later because he put diesel in the car. So after waiting back and feeding him and getting the car to the garage and getting it prepared, and thankfully it only cost $750 financial result. So that's it. But afterwards, based on that story, my wife and I called Evan into the room. We said, Evan, you know, it cost $750 to repair the car. And we paused and said, here's $750 for more flying lessons. Because it's a lot of grace, not a punishment. You're going to have to pay it back. No, we're just going to keep the double pound. And we gave the money. And hoping by the plot, that was just a moment for him to scream and scream. So I just love that story.
Yeah, Jim.
Mine's another one with my sons. I have four sons. And it's really interesting. Like, one of my sons, he's had two girlfriends, and both of the sets of parents sat him down. He gave him these stern talks about not viewing porn and gave him these books, very writing power kind of stuff, right? Which I don't do. And I'm like, well, you know, how's that working? You know, I mean, you know, do you enjoy being sat down by your girlfriend's parents and being sternly told that you're a pervert? And, you know, intact at all. And what I find is that amongst themselves, they have these kind of agreements that they're gonna, you know, not you. I didn't even know at this. I'm like, I don't even hear this from here. But you know, that they have these kind of pacts between themselves not to be porn, and they're constantly, you know, having their prints go to your brain on porn.com kind of stuff. And so they're like these huge advocates against it, but I have never ever tried to push them into that kind of, you know, hard moral stance of, you know, being against it. And the right-hand power approach is so much stronger because they're choosing themselves to go there instead of having the impress it on them. So they want it.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, that's what it means to everyone, doesn't it?
2,000 years?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think this notion of right-handed, I think it has a lot to say about like pastoral leadership. In ways, you know, what does it mean to lead a healthy congregation? Because like the right-handed, like, it's really effective and it's efficient. If you think about quantifiable goals, wanting to meet certain benchmarks to quantify success, like you can do that by exercising right-hand power. But if you think about the church as like just a network of relationships, and relationships are inherently inefficient, you know,
yep.
They're governed by the left hand, or they're you know, and I don't know, I mean, I just never thought about that. That's an interesting way to look at how you be a fruitful, healthy pastor and lead a fruitful, healthy congregation. But you do have to have rules and standards and whatever. But the heart of it is this left-handed, much more subtle, invisible, relational approach to power, which is an art, not a science.
And I want to get to you. I was just going to say, to add to that, it's risky too. I mean, there's no guarantee that that's going to work. Like, what sucks is there's no guarantee that there's an alternative to using right-handed power. Like Capon says, like, you know, it still probably will get you punched in the face, but at least there, on your end, you didn't burn any bridges for people. You know, you didn't become the antithesis of the gospel that you preach. You know,
I'm gonna say in 2006, Martin Dalboa told us to save the franchise. I forget the actual quotes, but it does seem to Martin the Sun. Martin the Sun about, you know, life is about avoiding it. Without taking the hits. And I think that's a leadership computer design. It's learning about stuff and anything like that, where it's not about avoiding getting hit, because not only should pastors, and there's one thing to talk about how pastors should avoid using right hand power, but their congregation, your board of trustees, is going to use them.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to hit you.
Yeah.
You can only, I mean, quote Jesus, you turn the cheek, or you can quote Rocky and just say, you gotta just keep getting hit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of the essence of left-hand power, is just taking those blows week after week, get some time in the pulpit, and preaching the only thing that can break through.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, even in these writings, Luther refers to the matter of religious power as kingdom, it's the kingdom of the left-hand power, one being the church and the state. But I do think there, what's that?
In the other direction.
Yeah, in the other direction.
The,
precisely.
The kingdom of the left is the left. Hand of power in the world.
Huh.
But going with cadence, it's the right hand power. That might change behavior, but it's the left using that might change the mind, might change the heart.
Yeah.
And it might be affected in the long run rather than just short term goals.
Yeah. I just want to move on, just so I can give you a picture of Capon the person. This, if you turn to the next page, this one's in the New York Times. So I said up there that he also is a food writer. And not everyone knows that, but he was a columnist for the New York Times for quite some time. And this is from 1983, The Case Against Heavy Cream, a Metaphysical Quibble. And so part of his tendency to kind of feel, I don't know, a sense of paranoia about the this distinction between risk and control is even spelled out in the way that he talks about cooking. You know, so here he is talking about the use of heavy cream and in the kitchen, and what he says about heavy cream is that, like, it's good, it tastes good. Yeah, it's bad for your health, but so is, you know, waking up in the morning. So, like, you should have heavy cream. But so here's the setting. It's a parliament kind of setting for the food authorities, and this young lawyer is making a case for heavy cream in a world that hates heavy cream. I'll read this one. The scene is the great hall of the International Parliament of Food Authorities. The president, having called the session to order, announces the first item of business, the consideration of a resolution to ban the use of heavy cream. He then recognizes the chairman of the Committee on Endangered Foodstuffs, who rises to address the group. Mr. President and fellow members, your committee has deliberated long and carefully over the resolution referred to us. Nevertheless, in order that your minds may have fresh evidence of the dangers it presents, we ask you to bear with us while we read it in its ominous entirety. Whereas heavy cream, since it contains saturated fat, contributes not only to high serum cholesterol levels and the formation of arterial plaque, but also to all the health hazards attendant upon those conditions. And whereas heavy cream is high in calories and therefore fattening. And whereas heavy cream is both unnecessary and expensive, and may thus, without detrimental effect, be either eliminated outright or replaced by substitutes. Okay, so they're laying out the rules and the reasons to not use heavy cream. And I hope you see the connection that there is this, you know, this theology of control and anthropology of control. And the gospel runs in the opposite direction. And what happens when you risk things is you might get some arterial plaque, but you may actually enjoy your life too. Let's go to the next page. And this is when he's getting into his argument. Calories are as irrelevant to the consumption of cream as inches or numbers are to the eating of pasta. Calories, inches, and numbers, in fact, are mere abstractions, beings of reason that have never, in the entire history of the world, been tasted, felt, or smelled by anyone. Nevertheless, even for those who choose to live their lives in bondage to such creatures of air and darkness, there's no reason to ban specific foods. They can simply eat less of everything. Fewer yards of linguine, fewer ounces of cream in smaller numbers, down even to the just one that supposedly nobody can eat, potato chips. The expensive cream is likewise irrelevant. Those who want to buy veal instead of tuna fish will forego whatever they must to make the expense possible. Indeed, there is hardly anyone who can't afford such an ordinary luxury as cream. The only sane rule is to think good first and cheap last, and to scheme until we can put our money where our minds are. Most irrelevant of all, however, is the claim that heavy cream is unnecessary. From a philosophical point of view, nothing at all is necessary except the uncaused first cause. Salt is unnecessary. Sugar is unnecessary. Ducks are unnecessary. The proponents of this resolution are unnecessary, and the universe itself is unnecessary. Accordingly, nothing in the world can be argued for or against on the grounds of necessity. I'm going to stop there just because we're going to run out of time. But I just wanted to give you a picture. This is in the New York Times. You know, this is someone who understands this gospel of freedom and the risk that it entails, and delights in the fact that like life is to be enjoyed and in the mystery of that. So I had to read the heavy cream piece. So this left-handed approach to like the religious calorie counter, the control freak in all of us, there's also this far more serious level of concern, because with left-handed and right-handed power, you get the sense that you can throw caution to the wind, to the calorie counter inside. But what about when things happen in life that are disastrous? You know, catastrophes happen, cancers happen, marriages collapse, and suffering happens in a way that can't be explained by a necessary cause. And when you need help in that situation, you could use some right-handed power, you know? Like you could use prayer to be answered in a right-handed way, you know? Cure this cancer, restore this marriage. And sometimes it doesn't happen that way. And so another thing I want to read is what Capon says about suffering and the presence of God in suffering. And he talks about the way that the scientific age, you know, being in the modern age where you can sort of demythologize everything. We know what stars are made of. We know how many there are. We know blah, blah, blah. But then he talks about the age where we actually believed that the stars made music and that the world sort of was present with love, you know, that love made everything go around. And he doesn't want to actually go back to this way of thinking, but he does want to say that there's something lost when we've gone to the scientific age, and part of that is the way that we view these places of suffering, sort of where the rubber meets the road. And so this comes from his short book called Third Peacock, which I would highly recommend. Mainly it's about the problem of evil, theodicy, and but this little bit is about Christ bearing himself in suffering and how he presents himself in suffering. Okay, so that should be on the next page. Would someone like to read? Okay, great, thanks.
So with God, perhaps, might not incarnation be his response not to the incidental irregularity of sin, but to the unhelpful presence of badness in creation? Perhaps in a world where, for admittedly inscrutable reasons, victimization is the reverse of the coin of being, his help consists in his continuous presence in all victims. At any rate, when he finally does show up in Jesus, that is how it seems to work. His much heralded coming to put all things to rights ends badly. When the invisible hand that holds the stars finally does its triumphant restoring thing, it does nothing at all but hang there and bleed. That may well be help, but it's not the band-aid that creation expected on the basis of mechanical analogies. The only way it makes any sense is when it's seen as personal. When we are helpless, there he is. He didn't start or stall the car for you. He comes and dies with you in the snowbank. You can object that he should have made a world in which caused you to stall, but you can't complain he doesn't stick by his customers.
Okay, pause for a sec. One thing that he's distinguishing is the idea of mechanical help, which is kind of right-handed help, and personal help, which is an image he gives is of, you know, during the death of a friend, there's a funeral wake, and people just sit with. And it's not that they've really put a band-aid on the situation, but their help comes not at the expense of erasing what what happened. The person has still died, but they just in their very presence, they are a help. And so he's saying here that Jesus, in suffering, that he's borne out in the suffering of human beings, is a presence. It's like this relational presence that is not a mechanical help, but a friend in need. Okay, so yeah, can we keep going?
Nevertheless, being broad-minded, Jesus is likely paradoxical, or inconsistent, if you like. He reserves the right to start a car for you at such times and places as you and he can work out in conference. Have mercy on me, son of David, says the woman of Canaan. And after a little verbal fencing and a few good, don't pronounce that, her daughter is made whole from that very hour. It's exasperating. Tiny minds would find Jesus easier to take. He never helped at all. He's going to make a principle out of victimization. Why does he shilly-shallying around with occasional answers to prayer? Once again, it's the mechanical analogy that makes the mischief. Answers to prayers for help are a problem only when you look on God as a divine vending machine programmed to dispense cokes, camels, lost keys, and freedom from gallbladder trouble to anyone who has the right coins. With the personal analogy, things are better. The word is like Martha. Given the circumstances, given the kind of free world he has chosen to make, he will do the best he can by you. It isn't that he has a principle about not starting cars or about starting them. What he has a principle about is you. Like Martha, he loves you. His chief concern is to be himself for you. And since he is God, that is no small item. His presence in the victims of the world, his presence in the cases where even his best is none too good, is still the presence of the Word who romances all things into being. Step out there in the snowdrift. You may feel that he should be doing something more than just trying to make it out at a time like this. But he obviously doesn't see it that way. He knows the home truth that grief and lovemaking are only inches apart, and his own dying, while he hangs helpless on the cross, he still, as the eternal Word, flatters nails into being. Wood into being wood, and flesh into being flesh. Love is as strong as death. The meeting waters God does not overcome, but there are no waters that can drown the loving of the Word.
Okay. We're running out of time, and there are so many things that I thought I was going to be able to get to, and I'm really sad, but I'm also glad that you guys have this little packet. The things that we didn't get to, Capon talks about heartburn, and this is in another book that we have called The Supper of the Lamb, which is a cookbook, and it's in the modern library of cookbooks. I mean, this sold very well, and he it's kind of this like story of faith and cooking. But the last chapter is about heartburn and the salve for heartburn being baking soda. And again, it's his way of saying that heartburn is actually a sacrament for the burning in our hearts for the love of God. And that sounds so corny the way I just said it, but it's actually, he does it so well. And I'm going to, speaking of the burning love of God, I want to play this. This is an old like radio show that he did, and you just have to hear his voice, because this is why I call this Salty Lamb, because he just has this like salty Long Island voice. So I'm going to play it, and then we'll be done.
That's a younger boy. The old boy is the one who about the lost sheep is not about the lost sheep, all the sheep, everything else gets lost. The parable is about the passion of the shepherd who lost the sheep to find the sheep. His passion to find is what drives the parable. And consequently, it isn't the prodigal's lostness, wasting all his money on wine, women, and so on in the far country. And it isn't the elder brothers grousing and complaining and scorekeeping that stands in. What counts in the parable is the father's unceasing desire to find the sons he lost, both of them, and to raise both of them up from the dead. The story, of course, you know. The story begins with the father having two sons, and the youngest son comes to the father and says, "Father, divide the inheritance between me and my brother." What he's in effect saying is, "Dear Dad, drop dead now, legally. Put your will into effect and just retire out of the whole business of being anything to anybody and let us have what we is coming to us." So the younger son gets the money and the older brother gets the farm and off the younger brother goes. What he does, of course, he spends it all, blows it all on wild living, and when he finally is in want, working, slopping hogs for a farmer and wishing that he could eat what he's feeding the pigs, but he can't stand it. When he finally comes to himself, he says, "You know, I've got to do something. How many hired servants of my father's are there? We have bread enough and to spare. I'm perishing here with hunger. I know what I'm going to do." And almost every preacher makes this the boy's repentance. It's not his repentance. This is just one more dumb plan for his life. What he does is, "I will go to my father and I say, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you.'" That's true. That was, he got that one right. "And I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." Score two. He gets that one right. But the next thing he says is dead wrong. He says, "Make me one of your hired servants." He knows, he thinks he knows, he can't go back as a dead son. And therefore he says, "I will now go back as somebody who can earn my father's favor again. I will be a good worker," or whatever. And while this is not a real repentance, it's just a plan for life, what it is enough to get him started going home. And consequently, when he goes home, what happens next is an absolutely fascinating kind of thing. What happens next is that the father is now, you must remember this, the father is now sitting on the front porch of the farmhouse. The farmhouse doesn't belong to him anymore, the front porch doesn't belong to him. He's sitting in the rocker that belongs to his oldest son, who is now, the owner of the farm. He's sitting there, he sees the prodigal, the young boy, coming down the road from far away. He sees him coming. What does he do? He rushes off the porch, he runs a half mile down the road, he throws his arms around the boy's neck, and he kisses him. Now, this is all that Jesus does with this scene. The fascinating thing in this parable is that in the whole parable, the father never says one single word to the prodigal son. Jesus makes the embrace, the kiss, do the whole story of saying, "I have found my son." Fascinating thing also is that when the father embraces the boy who has come home from wasting his life, the boy never gets his confession out of his mouth until after the kiss, until after the embrace. What this says to you and me, who have to live with the business of trying to confess our sins, is that confession is not a precondition of forgiveness. It's something that you do after you know you have been forgiven. Confession is not something you do in order to get forgiveness. It's something you do in order to celebrate the forgiveness you've got for nothing. Nobody can earn forgiveness. The prodigal knows he's a dead son. He can't perform as a son. And yet in his father's arms, he rises from the dead. And then he is able to come to his father's. Stop.
Okay, I'm going to stop there just because we need to move on to the next session. But isn't that great?
Where did you find that?
It is on. It's on Mockingbird, I believe. And if it's not, I'll put it up in the next week. But it's an old conversation that I just found by looking in the nether regions of the internet.
Yeah.
Just for anybody who wants to go to pay homage, go to our front door across the park and across the other park, a little bit to the south of Spikerton High School where he lives.
Oh. So we're within walking distance. Oh, awesome. Great. Thank you for that. Thank you, guys.